This is Steve Franklin with On Your Mind, talking with Jonathan Haidt, author of The Happiness Hypothesis. I just wanted to add, when we talk about concepts like, you talk about people who leave, going to the new city, thinking things are going to be better, it reminds me of Murray Bowen's concept in family systems theory of the emotional cutoff, that we think we can get away from our dysfunctional families by leaving them and not coming back, but we find that it doesn't actually tend to work out. Mm-hmm. You think you're getting away from it, and you're not even getting away from it.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it may work out for some people, but right on average, mm-hmm. It's not likely to work out as well as you think.
I also wanted to talk, when you use words, when you're talking about the Hindu experience, words like profane, to really understand their disgust, their sense of purity, and you create this dichotomy between purity and profanity, and you describe the modern West as the first fully practical profane system, and could you talk a little bit about how that might feed some of the fears of the Muslim world?
Sure. This is these are some ideas that are very common in anthropology, but they were very foreign to me, and they're kind of hard to think about if you're from a secular background, although they may be quite obvious to many of your religious listeners. So when I did some field work in eastern India, what I'm saying here may not be as true of the big cities, which are now quite modern, but traditional Indian villages, like traditional villages all over the world, are full of people who they see divinity, they see gods, they see sacredness everywhere. There are temples everywhere. Each day of the week has some sort of spiritual meaning. Colors have a particular meaning. You pray 3 to 5 times a day. Life in traditional India is not all about being productive and making money. It's about being in harmony with the cycles of religion and the universe. And it just felt so different. And when I was there, my research assistants would say to me things like, it's amazing to watch you work. You just decide what you want to do, and then you do it. Whereas to my Indian assistants, that's not the way life works. You don't just get an idea in your head and act on it. You have to follow the traditions, the rules, all the procedures. And I realized that I really did, in a way, come from a different planet. I came from planet America, where we're all about efficiency. If I want something, I should be able to get it 24 hours a day, delivered as fast as possible. We care so much about efficiency, we're quite happy to strip away some of the context, strip away some of the aspects of life that give life, just again, more richness. When I was a kid, most stores were closed on Sunday, and you couldn't shop at night. So there was at least, you had a sense that there was some rhythm to the day and the week. But not anymore. Now you can do just about whatever you want, whenever you want. Now that's good in a way. You know, it's more efficient. Maybe it's better for our economy. But we human beings need rituals, traditions, holidays, which are holy days, time off, vacation time, the Sabbath. We need things like this. I shouldn't say we absolutely need them, because, you know, we can live without them. We can live in this very efficient way. But life is missing something, and I think many Americans are picking up on this. This is why religion is never going to go away. People predicted that religion would somehow fade away with the advent of science, but in a way, it's been just the opposite. The more progress science makes, the more some people feel threatened by it, and feel the need to thicken up their spiritual and moral world. So you raised the issue of say, the way that radical Muslims feel threatened by the West. Oh, my God, absolutely. Not just radical Muslims, Christian fundamentalists, too.
Mm-hmm.
They look at what's on TV. They see children dancing around in sexy ways. They see women using their bodies for sex and not guarding their purity or chastity or virginity, and they're horrified. They're disgusted by this. They don't want the children exposed to it. So I think that we do have to understand that the way we live now, while it's efficient in many ways, it is deeply alienating and threatening and even disgusting to many people in the world.
Mm-hmm. So they fear not, perhaps not even so much as our military might. They fear our economic and cultural insinuation into other societies.
Mm-hmm. That's right. They don't want it happening to them. If you have a culture that's based very much on family authority, say a Confucianist culture in China or a traditional Hindu village, where the father is in charge of the family, maybe there are different castes, you respect your elders. If this is the way life has always been, well, the kind of the youth-centered egalitarianism of the West, which does not respect age, does not respect the position of the father in the family, this is deeply, deeply threatening. So, yes, this is part of what's driving much of the conflict worldwide. I was just reading, I teach a class on moral politics, or the moral basis of politics and terrorism. I was reading a letter that bin Laden wrote to the West to explain his actions after 9/11, and much of it, again, I'm not in any way excusing it, but I'm just saying what you said is exactly right. He at least justifies it by saying that we live a horrible life in the West, and this is one of the reasons why he has declared war on us.
And from what you've said before, what we would expect to happen is he will feel the disgust without thought, and then he will apply, his higher level functions to rationalizing that disgust. And
mm-hmm. That's right. Now, I don't know if that's exactly what's happening in bin Laden.
Mm-hmm.
He's a very canny man. He's a very tricky man. So he's going to say whatever he thinks is effective, as do all politicians. Our politicians do the same
mm-hmm.
thing. You can't really be sure that the politicians believe what they're saying, and that's as true of politicians. It's always been true of politicians. But I think what he's counting on is that he can make these arguments that will press emotional buttons among Arabs all over the Arab, among Muslims, I should say,
mm-hmm.
all over the Muslim world, and that will activate their sense of repulsion or disgust with the West. Now, even though many may be fascinated by it as well, if he can trigger repulsion, then he can bring them around to his side.
So if he can trigger the repulsion and at that moment right after the repulsion give you words to explain your repulsion in the way
exactly.
he wants you to think about it, that's a masterful stroke.
Exactly. If he can put it into a grand narrative, which is what he's trying
mm-hmm.
to do, which goes back 1,000 years, 1,500, to the early days of the caliphate, he's trying to work it all up into a grand narrative in which Islam is the hero and Christianity and especially Judaism is the villain, and so he's trying. He's doing what any good politician, or I should say, really demagogue, the extreme form of politician who will twist things to influence people. The way just as Hitler did. There's a battle for hearts and minds going on, and I do fear that America's not doing a very good job of appealing to hearts and minds right now.
So we have this phrase that initially described the invention of the United States, that individual states would become one nation, and that phrase was e pluribus unum, and now we look at the e pluribus, we look at the unum, and we're starting to bring together some of the ideas you've been talking about.
Well, yeah, I hope so. I mean, of course, the idea, when I was a kid, the idea of the melting pot was still very much respected.
Mm-hmm.
My parents would tell me how wonderful it was that Jews came to America, and it's not that they were welcomed with open arms, but they were kind of left alone, and Jews were very successful here. My
mm-hmm.
family assimilated, and that was just great. Well, in the 1980s, we had a much more politically correct kind of sensibility evolving, especially in the universities, where suddenly the melting pot was a terrible thing. How can we ask people to give up their identities? No, no, no. Spanish-speaking people should continue to speak Spanish. We can't make people be Americans. They have to keep their identity.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that's a terrible idea. We need a sense of unity. We need a sense of being part of one group. So I think assimilation is a wonderful, wonderful thing. Of course, people should keep some aspect of their identity, but it's crucial that people have an American identity first.
Then you get back to what I relate to your discussion of Kant's categorical imperative, which is if you're going to have some e pluribus and some unum, how do you decide what are the things that we should really expect people to take in common? What are the values that we expect we should be willing to impose, let's say, and what are the ones that we kind of leave alone because maybe they're not that important or they're not that clear?
Yeah. Well, that's the tough question. It's very hard to do that, you know, just by fiat, just by sitting down and picking some values. It kind of has to evolve from the culture. But the way I'm looking at it now is to say that the needs of the society are always shifting. And, you know, in the post-war period and most of this century, we had horrible discrimination against black people in particular and also against gay people and many other groups. So the politically correct movement in the 70s and 80s, in a way, it was well-timed, and it did many good things. It really did open up so many avenues. It really did knock down barriers for so many groups. So it was very important in its time. But now is a different time. And now we have more external threats. So it would make sense that we have to now look more for common ground and stop celebrating diversity quite so much and begin celebrating what binds us together. In social psychology, we have so many studies showing just how incredibly easy it is to get people to form groups that will be hostile to each other. If you point out any difference, any trivial difference, people will latch onto it and oppose those who are different from them. So I do suspect that celebrating difference, celebrating diversity, may backfire in many ways. Now, of course, we don't want to discriminate, and we want to welcome everyone, but I think we don't necessarily need to point out the differences so much.
And I think there's a way to celebrate diversity as source material in a way, and this is what I'd like to think you did. You looked at a diversity of materials. You looked purposely at Christian, at Muslim, at Greek, at conservative, at liberal, and you tried to figure out what are the things that really, even going to these diverse sources, do they seem to have in common?
Huh. See, that's very interesting. I never thought of it that way. In a way, the whole book is from many, one.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. That's a nice image.
Well, and I wish, again, I think it's a great model that kind of bridges some of that gap between the inclusivity and the diversity. And again, I think this is an international challenge when we talk about groups such as the United Nations. And you may, I couldn't find a lot on this, but you mentioned a model of the Youth Charter Movement. Could you just tell me real quickly more about what that is?
Yeah, there's a book out called The Youth Charter Movement or Youth Charter, something like that, by William Damon, Damon. I think he's the wisest person I know on the topic of moral development. And he wrote a book about a movement, I don't even know how big the movement got, but the basic idea was this. If you can lecture your kids all you want, you can do whatever you want at home, kids are really, really good at learning multiple languages. I mean, literally languages. You know, if the parents speak Spanish at home, the kids are going to pick up English very, very quickly at school. Well, it's the same way with morals. You can have a strict Christian upbringing at home, but, you know, the kids will very quickly pick up a different set of morals at school and a different set, you know, if they play basketball after school. So the idea of the Youth Charter is recognizing that kids will pick up all these differences. Well, if you make everything harmonized, if you get everyone together and say, okay, look, these are the values, these are the norms, these are the things we admire, and you get the teachers at school and the parents at home and the track coach and the priest and the minister and the rabbi to all say, Here are some things that we really can all agree on. And you know what? Despite our differences, almost all of us can agree. We want our kids to be honest and to not be violent and to be responsible and hardworking and respectful. You know, we do most of the virtues we really can agree on. And if you try to get them to all line up so that everybody reinforces everyone else's message, then you can be much more effective. in moral development and in training your kids. So that's what that movement was all about.
Spend some time trying to figure out what the areas of commonality are, reinforce them, and maintain some of the differences around the edges of that, instead of fighting so much to decide one or the other has to be the predominant.
That's right.
Thanks a lot for being with us, Jonathan Haidt, Dr. Jonathan Haidt, author of The Happiness Hypothesis, Finding Modern Truth and Ancient Wisdom. It was enjoyable and interesting and provocative to read. Thanks again for taking some time with us tonight.
My pleasure, Stephen. Those were some of the toughest, most interesting questions I've been asked yet on the radio.
Well, good. Thanks. I hope there'll be more like that.
Okay.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. This is Steve Franklin with On Your Mind, and... I will not be here next Wednesday at 11. In fact, I don't know when I'll be back. Somebody has bought out this time slot from under me, and we will find some way to get back to you. Until then, no matter how long it may be, I'll be back sometime. But until then, remember, don't panic.
WGNU, Granite City, St. Louis, 920 on your AM dial.